I think we're ready to go back on the record here. If counsel are ready, I think the witness will retake the stand, and I believe we were going to begin the cross-examination of Dr. Potion. Ms. Renzi, please go ahead when you're ready. Okay.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Brent.
Oh, Dr. Brent is sitting to your left.
No.
I'm sorry. Dr. Brent, you're right. Okay.
Sitting to my left.
Right. Okay. All right. Please go ahead then, Ms. Renzi.
I'm sorry, Dr. Potion, are you a medical doctor?
No, I'm not.
Are you a medical toxicologist?
It depends how you define the term medical toxicologist. What is your definition?
My definition would be someone who has both an MD and an expertise in toxicology.
I'm not a medical toxicologist.
Are you an immunologist?
I'm not an immunologist.
So you don't do experiments on immunology in your labs?
We don't always do experimental immunology.
You are not a neurologist, is that correct?
I'm not an MD, so I can't be a neurologist.
You don't know how measles virus affects the brain?
I spent 10 years of my research life studying virology. I have papers published in the Journal of Virology. I was the first one to show that a virus could transfer genetic information that was not in it originally. These are published in prestigious National Academy of Science and other places. I have a background in virology.
Have you ever published anything on measles virus?
As far as I remember, I don't think I have.
You are not a geneticist, are you?
I'm considered also to be a biochemical geneticist. The man I worked with for 3 years at Stanford University got the Nobel Prize for studying, while I was with him, for determining how DNA was synthesized, and was the first one to synthesize an active, biologically active DNA molecule. So from the years 1959, after I also went to Tufts University School of Medicine to teach, to 67, I was strictly a biochemical geneticist.
Do you study the genetics of humans? Have you ever done that?
Have I done what?
Human susceptibility. Genetic susceptibility in humans.
Oh, yes. We published a paper. It was the first paper of its kind in which we showed that a mother and her son in Mexico had a polymorphism in the gene that metabolized arsenic to a more toxic form. We have permission. We have a human experimentation committee at our school, and we all must be approved by that human experimental committee or institution review board before we can do human studies. I do have such permission.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on autism?
Not a peer-reviewed article.
I'm sorry, sir?
Not a peer-reviewed article.
Have you ever published any peer-reviewed articles on genetic susceptibility to mercury toxicity?
Now I've got to stop and think, because we have a lot of mercury papers. I'm not positive, but I think in a symposium talk that I gave at the National Institutes of Health on the toxicology of mercury and arsenic, that was published in, I think, the Environmental environmental health perspective. I'm not positive where it was published. But yes, we have published such an article.
Is that a peer-reviewed article?
Absolutely. It's sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
We've published several articles on mercury, is that correct?
Many. And they're all in peer-reviewed journals, beginning in 19, I think the first one was probably in 1956.
When is the last time you published a peer-reviewed article on mercury?
On mercury?
Yes.
I don't remember, but I want to say maybe 1999 or 200. It would be an environmental health perspectives article. We published so many papers, I can't tell you exactly what year what we did.
Of the articles you have published on mercury, have you ever published a peer-reviewed article on thimerosal toxicity?
No, we've done research on it, but they're not quite ready for publication yet.
On ethyl mercury toxicity?
On thimerosal.
Would you agree that the majority of your research has been in the area of arsenic and lead toxicity?
Certainly not in lead. I can't even remember a paper we've ever published in lead
toxicity.
Arsenic toxicity in recent years. In the time between 54 and 59, we only published on mercury. And then we started publishing on mercury again. The last human study we did in mercury was done in Mexico, where we mobilized mercury in people that were toxic to mercury. I think that was done, I want to say 97 or 99. I don't have my CV before me, but the first author was Dr. Gonzalez.
You say toxic to mercury. What kind of mercury are you describing?
I didn't hear the first part of your question.
You said that it was Mexico, a study in Mexico regarding mercury toxicity.
Yes, yes.
What type of mercury?
Done so long ago, I don't quite remember. Give me a minute to think. These people had been exposed to high levels of mercury, I think, and so long ago, that it was due to their working in a fluorescent light factory. The paper's published.
Mercury vapor? Methyl mercury?
It was probably mercury vapor.
Mercury vapor and ethyl mercury are different species of mercury, is that correct?
I hope you learned that from the talk I gave this morning.
I did, thank you. And different species of mercury have different toxicological properties, is that correct?
Yes.
Have you ever testified as an expert witness in other litigation?
I've been very fortunate that most of the cases I've been involved in have been settled out of court. And so many people think I bring a certain charm to such proceedings, but unfortunately it's not the case today.
Have you ever diagnosed or treated a person with ethyl mercury toxicity?
I'm not a physician, so I would not treat anyone.
So you've never treated or diagnosed a person with any form of mercury toxicity?
I have been asked my advice by physicians who think they may have a person who has mercury toxicity, and I've given them my opinion, but I did not do a diagnosis.
Have you reviewed the medical records of Michelle Sedillo?
I have reviewed some of them, but not all of them.
What records did you review?
A notebook about that thick, and that's about all I can tell you at this time. But again, I'm not a physician, and I certainly would not be expected to be expert on the various medical evaluations of such a person.
What types of records did you review? Did you review her immunization records? Did you review her general medical records?
I reviewed her general medical records.
And how many did you review, approximately?
I don't count such things. I'm sorry.
More than 100?
Again, I don't count such things. I just look at things, read them, try to store them in my mind. I don't put a number on the number of papers that I read. I either read a lot or a few. I've read a lot.
You read a lot. Is there any evidence or allegations that Michelle Cedillo's autism was caused by exposure to mercury vapor?
I don't know. I don't remember seeing that data, if it was there.
Is there any evidence or allegations that Michelle Cedillo's autism was caused by exposure to methylmercury?
I don't know of any case where anyone would say methylmercury per se was a cause of autism, or even speculating on such a line.
There's no evidence. Are you saying that methylmercury causes autism?
I'm saying I know of no evidence that methylmercury will cause autism.
Is there any evidence or allegation that dimethylmercury caused Michelle Cedillo's autism?
I doubt very much that Michelle was exposed to dimethylmercury, unless she went to a dump, and at certain dumps there in the literature, there's evidence that certain dumps emit methylmercury.
You're saying no, sir. Correct. She wasn't. That there's no allegation of dimethylmercury.
Yes. Okay, you're correct.
Is there any allegations or evidence that Michelle Cedillo's autism was caused by mercuric salts?
By thimerosal?
By mercuric salts.
By mercuric salt?
Yes.
I know of no evidence. However, the thimerosal that is in her vaccines would be expected to be converted to ethylmercury, which would be transported to the brain, and in the brain, the ethylmercury would be converted to mercuric mercury.
Are you familiar with the reference book, Cassaret and Duels? Cassaret and Duels, the reference book?
Oh, of course. Yes, I am.
Is it a well-regarded reference book used by toxicologists?
It is a reference book used by in toxicology classes.
Would you agree with the statement from that reference that, and I'll quote, no other metal better illustrates the diversity of effects caused by different chemical species than does mercury?
No. I thought I said in my opening remarks that the reason I was reviewing the forms of mercury for the court was because of the diversity.
So you agree with that statement? Would you agree that the toxicity of one form of mercury does not automatically apply to other forms of mercury?
I can't quite agree with that, because all the forms of mercury that I know of, if they get into the central nervous system, and in fact get into cells, are going to be converted to mercuric mercury. And there's a standing argument as to whether the toxicity of organic mercury is due to the mercuric mercury per se, or to the, let's say, organic mercury per se, or a combination of both.
You stated earlier that people are exposed to mercury on a daily basis. Is that correct?
I would hope to say that what form of mercury? We don't like to use the term mercury without specifying what form of mercury we're talking about. Like in that chart I gave, we had a column of amalgam mercury, or elemental mercury, a column for inorganic mercury, a mercuric mercury, and a column for methyl mercury.
So was your testimony that people are exposed to methyl mercury on a daily basis?
People are exposed to methyl mercury if they eat fish or seafood.
Or live near power plants?
Pardon?
Power plants
No, a power plant emits. A power plant emits elemental mercury. It doesn't emit, as far as I know, methyl mercury. The elemental mercury is then spewed out into the atmosphere, and when it rains, it is washed into the seawater or into the lakes and settles. And there is converted to mercuric mercury again, settles down, and is converted by bacteria to methyl mercury.
Okay, I'll rephrase my question. Would you agree that people are exposed to both organic and inorganic mercury on a daily basis.
I think you have to be very careful now. That's why we use species. For example, inorganic mercury, the major form of inorganic mercury is mercuric mercury. Mercuric mercury, most of the general population is not exposed to any great extent. Mercuric mercury toxicity is almost only seen in an occupational setting.
Would you agree that any substance is either toxic or non-toxic based upon the dose?
No. This is an ancient form of quotation that until recently we taught in medical schools and in undergraduate schools and graduate school. We now have to consider the hypersusceptibility of people. For example, you might be poisoned by X amount of some form of mercury. I might be poisoned by 1/100th of that amount because I may have a genetic hypersusceptibility. So the dose that I am given, will be very harmful to me, but that dose won't be harmful to you. So no longer can we use that ancient saying, and it's very ancient. This is now the year 2000. It's not the year, I think, 1000 BC or something like that, where Marcellus said this. But we no longer believe that the dose determines the poison. That is an antiquated belief in this modern age. Because now we know about genetics and hypersusceptibility of some people.
So toxicologists don't consider dose when considering the toxicological effects of substances.
That's not what you asked me originally. It is, if we can go back to what you just asked me, I'm not certain that's the question that you asked me. But essentially, we take dose in consideration, but it's not the only thing that determines toxicity. Dose is not the only factor that determines toxicity.
Would you agree, though, that any substance at a sufficient dose could be toxic to humans?
Of course. If I could kill you by making you drink so much water that it would overwhelm your system.
But you do not agree that dose makes the poison.
I don't agree that only dose makes the poison. I mean, that is an antiquated belief today. If I had a graduate student here answering your question, he would laugh. He would laugh because students are more up to date than many of us.
So you disagree with that statement? You don't agree that dose is the most important and fundamental principle in the study of toxicology?
I think I've said that in the past it was considered to be important, but today we know other things are just as important. Primarily the genetics of the individual, especially the hypersusceptibility of the individual.
What is the normal blood mercury level, or mercury blood level for an adult?
I don't know what the normal one is, but I would say that if it's under 5 micrograms per liter, it's considered to be not a clinical concern. And that's probably the average, what we usually see in an ordinary person.
What is the normal mercury blood level for a child?
Again, this depends on what the child has been exposed to. And there are all sorts of ranges, and I could not, without consulting a reference book, come up with the range and dose for a child, depending on his age and sex.
What is a high mercury blood level?
I'm not a physician, but if someone were to ask me in class that question, we would usually say that most physicians and most emergency medicine books will say that anything above 15 micrograms per liter of blood should have medical attention. Some people say even 20 micrograms per liter of blood should have medical attention.
What is an exceedingly high? You use exceedingly high in your report. What is an exceedingly high mercury blood level?
Where did I use the term exceedingly high? I may have, but I just don't remember. I'd like to be refreshed.
Did you use the word horrendously high?
Pardon?
Horrendously high?
I just, I don't have in front of me, so this is a call of the Lord, I want to tell the truth. So I don't know until I see what you're talking about.
You use it on page 4 of your report.
I don't have the report with me, so if you'd read it, or somebody let me see it.
When you were reporting about the dimethyl mercury exposure.
Yes.
Her blood mercury levels were horrendously elevated.
As I remember the New England Journal of Medicine article that Karen Guttenhauer had blood levels, I want to say 2,000 or 20,000 micrograms per 100 per liter. I honestly don't remember the exact number. But in many review articles, it says that's the largest concentration of mercury that's been found in the blood of almost any human being.
Dr. Kashi, when you discussed the several cases of mercury toxicity in your report, do you mention the dose amount of mercury or the mercury blood levels in those persons that suffered adverse effects?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I will try to speak up. I apologize. When you talk about, when you discuss the several different studies of mercury toxicity, you never mention the dose amounts of the mercury or the mercury blood levels in those persons that suffered the adverse effects. Is that correct?
I don't have the report. If someone would give me a
copy. Have you discussed the dose amounts today?
Pardon?
Have you discussed any dose amounts today or mercury blood levels today in your review?
Special Master, this is a question about a particular page of Dr. Kosh's report. Could Ms. Renzi kindly give us
Ms. Chikam, let's let her go on. She's asking a general question first, but if you get to a particular question, give us the page.
I can have the paralegal anything I refer to. It would probably be very difficult for me to walk over to Dr. Kashi with anything, but I'll just ask him for a little bit.
Certainly.
I appreciate it.
Do you ever mention, in your discussion today, did you mention either doses or blood mercury or mercury blood levels in any of your discussions of mercury toxicity today?
For the record, Dr. Pashin has been handed a copy of his report.
Okay. Now, Dr. Pashin, I think the last question she just asked you, you were asking now about his testimony today?
Correct.
Rather than his report?
Correct.
And so
I asked, in your discussions today with Ms. Chin Kaplan, did you mention either dose amounts or mercury blood levels in the persons that suffered adverse effects from mercury toxicity?
I don't recall, but I don't think so.
One of the things you mentioned in your report is the Fagan article. Are you familiar with that article?
Yes.
The Fagan article is a report of deaths in infants treated with high doses of thimerosal. That's on page 4 of your report.
Yes, I don't. What is your question, please?
I will ask you in a moment. Please be patient. How were those children exposed to the thimerosal in the Fagan study, the Fagan report?
I don't recall. I want to say they have been injected, but I haven't read that paper 6-7 months.
Would you accept that it was a topical thimerosal tincture, or would you like to look at the article?
If you say it is, I'm willing to accept your word.
You can look at the article. We can hand you that article, the Fagan article, which is Exhibit P, Attachment P of your exhibit.
Thank you.
For the record, Dr. Washington, the Fagan article, which you should refer to.
What's your question, please?
Do you know how long the children were treated with the thimerosal tincture?
Actually, I called Dr. Baker. He is now retired, living in England. And he could not remember that question, the answer to that question. I don't remember whether it's in here or not, but we were trying to find out what some of the blood levels of these kids were. And I see there is one in table one. And there's some written demonstrations. Yes, now I recall.
Okay. Was the exposure to the thimerosal tincture one time dose, or was it a chronic and prolonged period of time? Speaking as loud as I can, I apologize. Was the thimerosal tincture applied over a long period of time, or was it a single application? Report the dose of thimerosal that was it, the children in this study were exposed to.
I thought I asked Dr. Fagan that. The impression I had from Dr. Fagan's answer was that he didn't remember and that the dose was not mentioned. But again, I've not read this for 6 or 7 months, and I don't know the exact answer.
But there is a mercury blood level in that report, is that correct?
There is a blood level in table one, sure.
And that's the mercury blood level of a child at the time of his death, is that correct? Taken after his death.
One child, yes.
And what is that mercury blood level?
340, I think it's nanograms per milliliter.
Would that be about 1,340 micrograms per liter?
It would be, yes.
What is the blood mercury level of a child following the receipt of a thimerosal vaccine?
A normal child, the blood mercury level is given in the Cucciaro paper, I guess. But that's a normal child. It's not a child with a mercury efflux disorder.
And what is that level?
I don't have a paper in front of me. You have it. You probably know better than I do.
Well, you also referred to the Stijic article, which is exhibit...
You're talking down into your notebook, and I'm sorry.
The exhibit QQ. Exhibit QQ, your attachment is Stijic? Mr. Boxer will hand you the article. You filed it with your report.
Well, this is fascinating. What are you asking about the paper, please?
This article measured the blood levels in infants following hepatitis B vaccination. Is that correct?
Yes.
And according to that article, isn't the blood level of a child who receives a thimerosal-containing vaccine approximately 2.24 micrograms per liter? Approximately 600 times less than the mercury blood level following exposure in the Fagan article. You state in your opinion that higher doses of mercury have been shown to be toxic. Do you agree with that?
I need to know the context that is said in this original paragraph.
Are higher doses of mercury known to be toxic? Yes, there are higher doses of mercury known to be toxic. Mercury at higher doses known to be toxic.
What form of mercury are you talking about?
Methyl mercury.
Methyl mercury in various doses is toxic.
Is ethyl mercury.
Ethyl mercury in various doses is toxic.
What does various doses? Do you have specific doses at which the mercury can be toxic?
It depends on the species of animal that the study was done on. There are studies by Marcus and rat studies in mouse. I think there are one or two studies by Suzuki in Japan. Yes, I don't remember. To most of us toxicologists, doses are something that we can look up. We don't have to memorize.
What does the Fagan article? Does the Fagan article tell us nothing more that thimerosal at doses 600 times greater than the amount contained in a thimerosal mercury vaccine can cause an adverse reaction?
That's the Fagan article.
Does the Fagan article tell us anything about thimerosal at low doses causing adverse effects?
I don't think so.
Does that article tell us anything about thimerosal causing autism?
Definitely not.
Does that article tell us anything about thimerosal administered at low doses causing immune suppression?
This article does not deal with that subject. Would you like the references to the articles that do deal with thimerosal and mercury causing immune suppression?
We can get to those, sir.
Okay.
We can wait. I want to go back to the dimethylmercury exposure.
Yes.
And that was the chemistry professor who was exposed to the dimethylmercury. Is that correct?
You must forgive me. I have hearing aids.
I'm sorry. I will continue to speak up, sir.
You're talking in the microphone. I can hear you, but I know it's natural for you to look down at your notebook. I just can't hear you.
I'm a little short, and getting to the microphone means a big lean here, so I'm doing the best that I can. Back to the dimethylmercury exposure. Did the authors of that article, and that is article LL, would you like to see that article, sir?
I wouldn't mind having it. I know that it would help me answer any questions. Mm-hmm. Right now.
For the record,
I think it's technically attachment LL to Exhibit 55.
Thank you.
And that's the Nuremberg paper, is that correct? Who's the author on that article? Who is the author on that article?
Nuremberg.
Thank you. Did the authors of that article calculate the dose of dimethylmercury?
If they didn't calculate it here, they've calculated it elsewhere. But I presume it must be here also.
Do you know what that dose was?
I want to say it was something like 2 milligrams of dimethylmercury.
2 milligrams?
2 milligrams, that's what I saw. Remember. I could be wrong, but I think that was a dose that Coxon just told me personally that they made the calculation.
But you rely on the article. What does the article say, sir?
Because the density of dimethylmercury is very high, so there's a lot of mercury in that 2 milligram. I'm sure they say you may know where it is since you're asking the question.
On page 1675. Isn't that 1,344,000 micrograms?
That's what most of my students.
the micrograms in thimerosal and a thimerosal-containing vaccine of a hepatitis B vaccination?
We're talking about dimethylmercury here. We're not talking about thimerosal.
I understand that,
so
but my question was...
comparison is wrong. That's why we emphasize by thought the species of mercury.
So you don't believe that the two...
answer to your question, the thimerosal vaccines total about 180 or 200 micrograms of mercury.
In a hepatitis B vaccine?
I don't know exactly what it is. Either 12.5 in hepatitis B or 25.
So you agree?
Agree to what?
That the exposure to dimethylmercury is not comparable. You can't compare that to an exposure in a thimerosal-containing vaccine.
I don't know if anyone has made that comparison. All we're saying, I think one could want educated group to know that dimethylmercury is the most toxic form of mercury we know.
So this case study simply illustrates that different forms of mercury have different toxicological properties. Is that correct?
I think that's what everyone knows even before this paper.
You stated today that inorganic mercury is trapped in the brain and then is not eliminated. Is that correct?
Again, slowly repeat that, please.
You stated today that inorganic mercury...
Mercuric mercury.
Is that inorganic mercury?
It is one form of inorganic mercury.
Is trapped in the brain and is not eliminated. Is that correct?
It's practically not eliminated. It stays there for a long, long time.
And in support of that, you cited two case studies. Is that correct?
There are two case studies that indicate that many years after the exposure, the amount of mercuric mercury, in this case it's organic mercury, as they said, was extremely high and remains that high over a number of years.
And one was the family in Mexico that you discussed today that ate, consumed a pig following the pig's ingestion of methylmercury. Is that correct?
Well, the case in New Mexico was a pig knocked over a bottle of fungicide, which was methylmercury chloride, and drank it. The next day, the family killed that pig and within a few days used that for food. There were three children, two very young ones. One died shortly thereafter, and the other one lived for either 20 or 21 years.
Okay, can I just interrupt you for 1 minute? Okay.
At 20 or 21 years later, everyone was astounded to see that in a human being who had been exposed to methylmercury 20 or 21 years previously, the brain inorganic mercury, mercury, was 100 times more than normal.
And I think you stated that earlier today. Do you know the approximate amount of methylmercury that was consumed by the family members?
I don't think anyone knows that. I don't remember the papers even trying to come to terms with that.
Do you know over what period of time the pig was consumed by the family?
It was either over a 6 month period or a period of 1 year approximately. They didn't have freezers in those days.
But would you agree that the family's exposure to methylmercury was at a much higher dose than a dose of ethylmercury that is received through the administration of the thimerosal-containing vaccine?
Of course, everyone knows that.
Were blood mercury blood levels reported in that case?
I don't think so, but I'm not positive, because the main emphasis of that paper was the amount of mercury in the child's brain, or in the adult brain.
Did any of those family members develop autism?
This was done at least 20, 25 years ago, which would make it around 1970, I would guess. I don't think autism was a concern of any doctor or anyone making a diagnosis. I don't think people
in the 70s
were thinking about autism.
And when was that? I'm sorry, what was the date?
My guess is it's around 1970, but I'm not positive.
Was there any reports that any family members were immune suppressed following the consumption of the pig?
You've got to understand. understand that this is in a very rural part of New Mexico. I don't know whether you've ever been to New Mexico.
I have.
But in the rural parts of New Mexico where people eat pigs that they grow, they're lucky if the physician treating them was even thinking about it.
But they did do a case study on this, so there had to be some sort of follow-up of this family. Is that correct?
The only published report on this family that I know of is of the child dying 20 or 21 years later. There may have been another one, but I'm not aware of it.
There was one, was the mother pregnant when she consumed the methylmercury in that study? Would you like to see the study? We can hand you that as well.
Pardon?
Would you like to see the paper by Davis that we're talking about?
No, if it's not.
And it is attachment N. Attachment N for the record.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, now I remember this one, yes. And what's your question about it?
There was a child in that study who actually had prenatal exposure to the methylmercury. Is that correct?
Again, I haven't read this paper for years. Can you say it's correct?
Well, you cited it in your report, which you wrote on February 16, 2007. So if you haven't read this article in years...
Which said what about a pregnant woman?
Well, you cited the paper, so I had assumed that you were aware of the study.
I stated it was a pregnant woman in the bottle. I could be wrong. But again, I have to read so many papers.
So you don't know in the article that you cited whether there was prenatal exposure to one of the family members? If you don't know, you can just answer no, that's fine.
I don't hear all the questions.
I said, so you don't know whether...
I don't know what?
Whether we'll finish. If you let me finish my questions, I'll try to remember to have you finish your answers. So you don't know whether, in the article that you cited, whether one of the family members was exposed to methylmercury through consumption of that pig prenatally.
Since this is a court of law, I want to be absolutely truthful. And I have a sneaking suspicion what it may have been, but I'm not positive.
Okay. So you don't know if any child... So you don't know if there were any neurological symptoms of a child due to prenatal. We'll move on, sir. You also refer to, in your report, the 1994 Opitz article, and that is exhibit attachment MM of your exhibit.
Which attachment?
MM.
NM, thank you.
M like in Mary M.
Okay.
If you would like to see it, yes. Have you read that article recently?
Yes. This is from Germany.
When is the last time you read that article?
If I had to make a record every time I've read the article, I don't keep such things in my mind.
I didn't ask how many times you've read it. I asked when is the last time you read it. Have you read it since... Did you?
I have no idea. I'm not going to tell you the truth, but I have no idea.
What was that article? What was that article about?
This is an article, if I remember correctly, of a man being exposed to mercury vapor, metallic mercury vapor. And he was treated with e-penicillin, which we were the first one to use to come up with as far as the therapeutic agent. Our laboratory did that. They did a body cart. Again, they found neurocell damage. So what else would you like to know?
In your report on page 6.
Page 6 of this article?
Of your report. I'm sorry, sir. Oh. Your report?
Could someone get me my report if I'd known that...
I think we handed you your report, sir. You should have it.
Thank you. Okay. Page 6. I have page 6.
Okay. First big paragraph. the Davis study, another one, six lines up.
From the bottom?
Yes, from the bottom of that paragraph. You state, in another study, exceedingly high levels of mercury were demonstrated in the human brain and other organs 17 years after phthalic mercury exposure. And my question to you is, what is exceedingly high? Exceedingly high?
I would define anything high that's above what we normally see. And this is above what we normally see.
But what is exceedingly high? Is that, can you quantify exceedingly high? Is there a toxicological term that quantifies exceedingly high?
No, I would just take the values reported in the textbooks of emergency medicine and the toxicology textbooks reported as they get normal values, and depending on how large that the number you're talking about is, compared to that base value, I would say it was high or exceeding high.
The Opitz article that you, do you have the Opitz article in your hand now? Do you have the Opitz article in your hand?
Yes.
Okay. And is that the mercury urine? There was a mercury urine level in that report. Is that correct?
I don't. It's certainly table 2 doesn't have one. So let's see what table 3 doesn't have one. Let's see what table 1 does. Table 1 does not give a urinary value either. I don't know whether in the text there was a urine value. But my guess was from the book of the autopsy, you probably did not get the urine value, but I don't know.
Where it says case report. No, I was looking for my glasses, to be honest with you. A little blind with a small print. On the first page of that article.
And the autopsy.
Opitz article under case report.
On the first page?
Yes, sir. A male subject, age 57 in death, had worked for 13 years in the recycling of a mercury from amalgams with a mercury content of 1 or 2%. He suffered from an acute exposition of mercury vapor at age 41. Immediately after intoxication, he excreted 1,850 milligrams per liter of urine. My question is that the equivalent of 1,850,000 micrograms?
Yes. Yes.
And is that how you would define that exceedingly high dose? When the mercury excretion...
That certainly is not a low dose. Usually what you see in the urine is in the order of magnitude of 5 micrograms per liter, or sometimes a little more, but this would certainly be a high dose. It would be an exceedingly high dose.
So is this article, could you compare this article? Can you compare this article then to thimerosal content in vaccines? Exposure by a thimerosal containing vaccines.
What part of this article?
The dose. The dose, sir.
No, I cannot.
You also discussed today, and in your report, Minimata. Is that correct? And at Minimata, there was exposure that of methylmercury through consuming of contaminated fish. Is that correct? Do you know if there were any blood?
I apologize.
Could you answer so your voice can be recorded? You have to answer yes or no, and not at the head. The court reporter will pick it up.
Answer the questions that were asked me earlier.
Do you know if...
I'm sorry, just for the record, because the witness hadn't responded to it. Because he nodded in his head.
Yes.
In response to Ms. Renzi's last question, he nodded in your phone.
It's not, it's for the court reporter that you. It's important that you don't nod your head, but that you answer yes or no. Thank you. Do you know if any methylmercury blood levels were measured in any of the victims at Minimata?
Certainly they were. I don't know what they were.
Would you believe that they would be higher than blood levels following thimerosal containing bags?
I don't know what the data is. It's conceivable that there might have been some people there. I just don't have the data.
You don't
some
have the data.
Some people could be hypersusceptible at a low level. I don't have the data. Sorry.
In Minimata, there were also birth defects as a result of pregnant women who consume fish during their pregnancy. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you described a cerebral palsy type syndrome in these children?
Yes.
Do you know over what period of time the methylmercury exposure took place in Minimata?
At least 2 years, and maybe even 5 years, and then even more. You must realize that it's been at times very difficult to get some information from Japan. The word Minimata in Japan is now synonymous because of the effects on the brain with the word idiot. So if someone wants to insult in the Japanese, call you as we say you're an idiot, you would say you're a Minimata.
But my question to you is, was it a chronic exposure or was it a short-term exposure?
Again, you're talking about a population.
Is 2 years a chronic exposure, or is 2 years...
We're talking about a population. Some people would have one meal, it depends how much fish they ate. But it certainly would not be expected to be a short period. It's chronic exposure.
So they consume the fish over an extended period of time.
Yes.
Thank you. Is there any evidence that the children at Minimata had an increased rate of autism compared to the general population?
Again, people were not aware of autism as a disorder of children at that time, especially in Japan.
Do any of the neurological symptoms described in these children comport with a diagnosis of autism?
You must realize, again, that the signs and symptoms of methylmercury toxicity are relatively nonspecific, and that many people would have such symptoms thinking that they were ill for some other reason. And that's what Chris has to say.
What were the symptoms? What were the neurological symptoms? In the excuse, you call it a cerebral palsy type syndrome. So they must have recorded some of the symptoms.
Many symptoms. For example, there were movement disorder symptoms. There certainly was a decrease in the intelligence of the children that were born. There's a general feeling of being ill. There's GI upsets, and there are other symptoms of which I just want to make a point of remembering because there are things in the position to deal with.
And what is this reference for those symptoms? I'm sorry, what is the reference for those symptoms described at Minimata?
There are three or four, there are many books written by the Minimata Research Institute. They're all, if you have any trouble
you agree, Dr. Boshian, that for most of the period in utero, that the blood-brain barrier is not as fully formed as it is postnatally?
Yes.
You state in your report and you discuss today pink disease, correct? And pink disease was a condition that resulted from the use of mercuric salts. Is that correct?
Mercuric
salts.
In your report, that I was shown was that mercuric really was exposure to mercuric.
Mercuric salts, I apologize.
Mercuric was converted to mercuric in the body, but the exposure, the initial exposure, is mercuric.
Mercuric salts, thank you for correcting it. And it was topically applied to the gums of infants, correct?
But I'm not quite sure how much tissue is exposed when the tooth is beneath the blood. The simple topical application seems to me to be a very simple way of looking at it.
And did you describe earlier the symptoms of pink disease? Did you not?
Yes.
Could you go through them again, please?
Sure. You might have to go back and give the exact words.
Well, if you know them off the top of your head, that would be helpful, but if you want to go back, if you have a list of symptoms, that would be fine.
Doctor, do try to speak up.
Please. Oh, I'm sorry. Anyway,
just one moment, please.
The,
doctor, one moment here. We're going to check the microphone, see if it's your microphone, see if it's working correctly.
I'm trying to think the best way to answer that question. We wanted to investigate that, and we went back over records and could find nothing. I was contacted by people in Australia. Australia had a lot of pink disease. Australia supposedly kept their records. And when the people contacted me from Australia, knowing that we're interested in autism and mercury, they said they would be willing to cooperate. And I said, I need the medical records before we invest government money to come all the way out to Australia to do a survey and do mercury levels in you all. Because there is a survivor of pink disease society in Australia. After they looked into it, they could find no hospital records that would give us that data. So there's no, and again, in those days of pink disease, 1890 to 1950, autism wasn't even considered to be a childhood disorder. I don't think, I'm trying to think when the psychiatrist thought of the ridiculous statement that autism is caused by refrigerated mothers. And that's about the time.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but the answer is you don't know.
I don't know what?
You don't know if there was any evidence of an increase in the
diagnosis. No one looked for it. No one looked for it.
Is there any evidence of an increased rate in immunosuppression in the children who had pink disease as compared to the general population?
Again, no one looked for it.
So you don't know?
No one looked for it. We can't find, the absence of evidence doesn't mean that there's evidence for absence.
Do children with autism show signs of pink disease?
I don't think so. I've never made the claim that they did.
And you used pink disease. You stated on page 9 of your report, and you said today, that the fact that the mortality of children was not 100%, this demonstrates a genetic hypersusceptibility of some children to mercury that plays a significant role with respect to the nature and extent of the injury. Is that correct?
Yeah. One out of 500 children
exposed to mercury salts and the teething powder in the Cochrane articles clearly states one out of 500 got pink disease. And so why did the others?
Well, do you know the amount of mercurous salts that were contained in any particular teething powder?
No.
Do you know the dose of mercuric salts that were administered to any of the infants that developed Pink's disease
no.
when they died?
No.
Do you know their mercury blood levels?
No one ever did a mercury blood level on Pink's disease that I know of. There's no published report of a blood level of mercury in Pink's disease. I've said to you earlier in the report of the talk I gave this morning that established medicine was not willing to admit that, was not willing to agree that Pink disease was caused by the teething powder, and it was only after the government forbid the use of this teething powder containing mercurous chloride that Pink disease disappeared. No one did a mercury study.
So you don't know the dose of the children who received the mercuric salts that did not,
absolutely
that did not
no.
have symptoms, with those who had symptoms and recovered, or the doses of the children who received
correct.
The mercuric salts?
I don't.
Doctor, if you could wait until she finishes her questions, then we can get a better record. Thanks.
Do you know if there were any limitations to the dose amounts the parents could administer to the infants? Parents could administer the teething powder anytime they thought it was needed. Is that correct?
You have to repeat the question, please.
Were there any limitations on the application of the mercuric salts in the teething powder?
Not that I know of.
The parents could administer the teething powder as often as they thought it was needed. Is that correct?
I don't know.
But isn't it true that unless you compare the dosages of the mercuric salts between those infants who suffered reactions and those that did not, it is just mere speculation that these adverse reactions were a result of genetic hypersusceptibility?
Speculation means that there's no evidence for a concept that one is trying to put forth. There certainly is evidence that there are people hypersusceptible to mercury. Whether some of these children were hypersusceptible and got Pink disease, we have no evidence one way or the other.
Doctor, is it fair to say, I'm going to move on, that you have performed a significant number of studies involving chelation?
I have performed a number of studies on chelation for the drug that is used now for the FDA-approved treatment of children with lead poisoning. We did all the human metabolic studies as to what happens to this drug, DMSA, in the human body, and we did much of the work showing that this compound would also chelate mercury.
And you've published peer-reviewed articles on chelation, is that correct?
Many of them.
Have you ever published a peer-reviewed experimental study on chelation where you did not take both pre-chelation and post-chelation urine measurements?
To my knowledge, we have never done that because that is, we've always insisted that we do a pre-chelation baseline. Many of the studies that have been reported just don't do a baseline, so all they can say is the mercury is at this level. We have always done a baseline, a pre-chelation plus a post-chelation study.
That's the way you assess the effect of the chelator, is that correct? That's the way you assess the effect of the chelator, is that correct?
That is one of the ways you assess the chelator. That's the best way.
And without pre- and post-chelation urine levels, what would the study tell you? Without getting both pre-urine and post pre-chelation and post-chelation urine levels, what would a study tell you?
What it could tell you is that we have a vast amount of literature that tells us what the normal range of a person's human urinary mercury excretion is. That normal range, we often say, if it's above 15 micrograms per liter, you should see a physician. Clinical intervention is recommended. So if someone is chelated and he has 100 or 200 micrograms of mercury per liter, we're certainly going to say, you better go see a physician and have this taken care of, or the physician should do this. And if someone calls me, I tell them, well, wait a week or so and get a baseline again. Let's see what the baseline value is. So a baseline value is definitely the proper way of doing it.
You discussed today about the possible adverse effects of dental amalgams. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you state in your report also that the average number of amalgams, that the average person with the average number of amalgam surfaces emits about 10 micrograms, emits and retains about 10 micrograms of mercury from those amalgams. Is that correct?
That's a figure that many people use.
Could you cite to, well, who is the average person?
The average person is the person with the average number of amalgam surfaces in this country.
What is the average number of amalgam surfaces?
Usually considered to be about 10 in this country. Other people will give you another number.
Has there ever been an association between dental amalgams and autism? Dental amalgams cause Alzheimer's disease?
I don't think there's enough evidence to show that one way or the other. The evidence that is available is not the best.
Do you believe that dental amalgams cause Parkinson's disease?
Again, I don't think the studies have been good studies. Whether amalgams do or do not cause Parkinson's disease, I don't think there's enough good evidence available to make a decision.
You state in your report that the proposition that dental amalgams actually cause these diseases is not generally accepted. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And when you say not generally accepted, do you mean in the scientific and medical communities?
May I elaborate on that? There is a term that we use called micromercurialism. And by micromercurialism, we mean those people who have a level of mercury in them that is not excessive but will cause some sort of physiological response.
And sir, I hate to interrupt, but you're not answering my question.
Pardon?
My question is, when you say something is not generally accepted, do you mean by the scientific and medical communities? I don't think that you're responding to my question.
Yes.
Are you aware that the U.S. Public Health Service, the World Health Organization, the American Dental Association, and the National Multiple Sclerosis Association, among many, have determined that dental amalgams pose no risk to public health?
May I take some time to clarify that point? About a year, September 7th and 8th, or 6th, 7th, and 8th, in a town near Rockville, Maryland, a meeting was held by the FDA to discuss this question. The FDA wrote a paper, which is available on the web, stating that dental amalgams were not dangerous, were safe. There are no harmful effects. For the first time for the FDA, rather than just a dental committee, they had a committee made up of
the dental committee of the FDA and the neurology clinic, the neurology committee of the FDA. First time they've ever done this. The neurology committee were first class physicians from many academic, many medical schools. In addition, they had three or four consultants that they that the neurology committee asked for to attend. They had Claussen, who is a prime example of a first-class toxicologist. They had Michael Ashner from Vanderbilt University, and they even had a dentist consultant. All right, that committee, I think there were 13 neurology and neurology consultants and seven dentists. That committee voted 13-7 not to accept the FDA paper that said that amalgams were safe. It's the first time that's been done. So we now have on record by the FDA, by an FDA impartial committee, the statement by the majority of these two committees saying that the question is still open whether amalgams are safe or not, that more work has to be done. That's in the federal, you can get this off the web, it's available.
More
if you
work.
Have any trouble getting out, I'm glad to send it to you.
More work needs to be done, is that what you said, Doctor?
Certainly more work has to be done.
But the societies I named earlier state that their dental amalgams pose no health risk.
I'm sorry?
The societies I read to you in my last question state that dental amalgams pose no public health risk. I did not mention FDA.
I don't understand your question.
Are you aware that the U.S. Public Health Service, World Health Organization, American Dental Association, and the National Multiple Sclerosis Society have determined that dental amalgams...
Will you tell me the dates of those? Please?
Doctor, please let her finish the question, okay?
I do not have the dates.
I think that if you look it up, you'll find that the U.S. Public Health Service made that statement around 1996 or 1997.
Okay, thank you.
And that the other statements, and if you ask most scientists, they're not at all amazed that the American Dental Association would make such a statement.
You're currently conducting in vitro and in vivo studies on the metabolism of arsenic, correct?
I think I know your question, but would you say it louder in the...
Are you currently conducting studies, both in vivo and in vitro, on the metabolism of arsenic?
We have, yes.
And in, what is an in vitro study? What is an in vitro study?
Well, an in vitro study usually means that you're not taking a whole organism, whole animal. You're taking either cells of that organism or you're taking isolated enzymes of that organism. It's not the whole animal. In vitro implies it's not the whole animal. It's just a part of the animal that you're isolating and studying.
So in other words, there's studies carried out in isolation from a living organism. Is that correct? They're usually done on a petri dish? They're not carried out in isolation.
The cell is indicative of a thousand other cells or a million other cells in the animal.
But it's
so
separate.
It's not in isolation of the individual.
But it's an isolation of the entire living organism. Is that
Pardon?
Correct? It's an isolation. It's not the same as the entire living organism.
It's
is
not
that correct?
Correct. It's not like the entire organism.
And in vivo studies take place in living organisms, is that correct? In vivo studies, they take place in living organisms, is that correct?
In living organisms. But some people would say a cell, an isolated cell, a tissue culture cell, is a living organism. And that's an in vitro study.
You're performing in vivo studies currently on mice, is that correct?
We do, at the present time studying methylmercury in mice, trying to get the mercury out of the brain, in vivo.
Do you always expect the same results from in vivo and from in vitro and in vivo studies?
It's difficult to say. It depends on
how well the experiment is designed. Usually, historically, in medical science and biomedical science, an in vitro study will precede an in vivo study, because an in vitro study can be done very inexpensively, whereas an in vivo study, whether it's done in an animal or a human being, is very expensive and more time consuming.
But you normally do both, is that correct?
We normally do both, but not all the time.
But if you would expect the same results from an in vitro study as you would from an in vivo study, then you wouldn't have to do both, is that correct?
No, because there are always some people that are, for one reason or another, either don't believe an in vivo study or don't believe an in vitro study. So it's just easier to do both experiments so you don't have to argue at some meeting whether these studies are relevant.
But you can't conclude from an in vitro study what will happen in vivo. Is that correct?
That's incorrect.
You can conclude from any in vitro study. You can conclude from any in vitro study what will happen when you perform that same experiment in an entire living organism, in an in vivo study.
Very often I can predict it.
Very often? How often?
95% of the time.
Then why do you do both?
Because I've told you, I'll go to a meeting, I'll present an in vitro study, and someone who won't know very much about the basic ways of doing experiments will say, oh, I don't believe in an in vitro study, it's really an isolated part of the animal, and so it's just easy to say, well, we've also done the in vivo study. So there's no sense of arguing this and taking the public time. We've done the in vitro study and the in vivo study. Both studies show the same thing, or both studies don't show the same thing. But most of the time, in our hands, working with arsenic and mercury, both studies would show the same thing, with one exception, and that is when we're trying to find the enzyme or the mechanism by which ethyl mercury was deethylated and methyl mercury was demethylated in the brain.
Okay.
Then we had to take, then we had to take brain slices because we could not do this in the whole animal. We were looking for the enzyme.
So when you do an in vitro study, you can predict how that will happen, what will happen if you do the same study in a human
being. Very often.
How often?
I told you, just told you, I think about 95% of the time. But that's because I've been doing this a long time. And it depends also on what kind of study you're doing.
Attachment B, if you're in, when you do animal studies, when you do an in vivo animal study, can you use that study to conclude what will happen when you do the same experiment in a human being?
Now you're getting into a very difficult field. You're asking whether we can extrapolate what goes on in an animal with what goes on in a human being. And this depends on what kind of experiment you're talking about. If you're to ask me, what is the effective dose of an antibiotic in a mouse as compared to a human being, probably is quite different. So you'd have to do an in vivo study there. But if you were to ask me, if you were to ask me whether the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase is present in a liver slice as well as a complete animal, I'd say yes, absolutely present. Both
present.
Cases.
You said they're both present, so you know that some organisms contain the same liver, like both a human and an animal.
Yes.
Have present a liver. Is that what you're saying? But if you perform an experiment on that liver in the mouse and in the human, do you expect to get the same results?
Again, it depends on what you mean by the same result. Do we expect to find an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase in a mouse liver and the human liver? The answer is yes. If you say, how much alcohol dehydrogenase do you expect to find in a mouse liver as compared to a human liver, I would say probably different.
Well, let's talk about attachment B of your report, and I think it's an article authored by you on chelating agents. And if you would like that study, we can hand that to you.
I apologize, not I'm better prepared.
No, that's why we have that's why we have someone here to hand these things to you.
And so what are you talking about?
I'm talking about attachment B. This is the article you authored on chelation. The chelation of mice, specifically.
Is it the ocean post article?
Yes.
My dear wife has a better brain than I have. I wish you were here. Yes, but we're talking about.
Did you conclude from that study that the chelating agents you use on mice would have the same effect on humans from that one study?
You're talking about this article.
Yes.
This is a review article. It's not an experimental article. It's not a report of an experiment. There may be an indication or a reference to a certain article. You have to tell me on what page you're talking about.
And you're looking at Mezzo 2-3, the DSM article?
Which one?
It's Exhibit B. Could you read the title of that article? Could you please read the title of that article?
The title is Meso-2,3-dimer caprocytic acid, chemical pharmacological and toxicological properties of an orally effective metal chelating agent. Is this the article you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
And is there some item in this article on a page that you can tell me about?
Yes, if you could go to page 302, please.
302. Some people write too much. Very last one. 302.
And you state in that article, the DSMA is biotransformed into a mixed disulfide.
Can you tell me where on this article, what paragraph?
It is the second paragraph. The second paragraph. Second paragraph on page 302.
You mean DMSA is biotransformed?
Yes.
Okay.
And you state in that article that the DSMA is biotransformed into a mixed disulfide in humans. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But that you did not find the mixed disulfide. You found it in humans, but that you did not find it in rabbit, mouse, or rat urine. Is that correct? So there's an experiment that you performed on humans and on animals where the results were different. Is that
I'm
correct?
I'm really surprised.
Is a mouse dendritic cell the same as an intact human immune system?
I'm not a histologist. I really can't tell you whether they are the same or not. My guess would be that they're very, very similar.
A mouse dendritic cell is the same as an intact immune system.
As far as its function is concerned, I would think they would have a very, very similar function.
So a human dendritic cell is the same as an intact human immune system. One cell is the same as the whole system. Is that what you're saying, sir?
I think you started to answer the question before you heard the end of it. She was not. So why don't you ask your question before?
I apologize.
That's all right.
Is a mouse dendritic cell, one mouse cell, the same as an intact immune system in a human being?
I don't know.
Is a human dendritic cell, one cell, the same as an intact human immune system?
I don't know.
You don't know. Do you know what a dendritic cell is?
Pardon?
Do you know what a dendritic cell is?
Yes.
What is it?
It's a cell that is responsible for many of the immune responses where macrophages are made and come out of.
Are there many of them or few of them in the human body?
I'm not an expert witness in immunology.
You're not an expert witness in immunology.
To be an immunologist, and I'm incompetent to answer any questions that you have about immunology as an expert immunologist would.
But you state in your report that you find the in vitro studies of Galt and Agarwal highly significant. Do you recall that in your report?
I recall that very well.
And although you're not an immunologist, what do you mean by highly significant?
Because the concentration of thimerosal that was used in that experiment was almost equal to the concentration of thimerosal that you'd expect in the cell of a child that was exposed to vaccination.
And would those studies be as highly significant if the dose were higher than those found in thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I'd have to think more about that.
So you believe that in vitro studies on mouse dendritic cells and on isolated human dendritic cells can be used to conclude more likely than not that small doses of thimerosal will cause immune dysfunction in the human, in a human body.
Can you remind me of the last part of that sentence?
Do those in vitro studies, by highly significant, do you conclude that those in vitro studies tell you how thimerosal will act in small doses in the human body?
I think it would be an indication. It would be a lead as to what we should do next. What is important is that at that dose of thimerosal, there was an effect.
So it helps form a hypothesis as to what will happen in the human body. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are there any studies in humans that conclude that small doses of thimerosal, such as those contained in thimerosal-containing vaccines, cause immunosuppression?
Not that I know of, but I'm not an immunologist and would not be familiar with that literature.
In the Agarwal and Goff studies, the dendritic cells were exposed to thimerosal and not ethyl mercury. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And do you know whether in vitro, I know you're not an immunologist, but whether the thimerosal would metabolize into ethyl mercury the same way it would in the human body?
I don't know the answer to the question, but I would suspect that it would be metabolized very quickly, SH group would split off the ethyl mercury very, very rapidly in even the dendritic cell.
That would be your guess, that it would agree with?
That would be my opinion based on what I know about hydrogen groups, disulfide bonds, and the stability of such compounds, and what the literature says.
What literature is that?
The literature by many people, Kurush, I think Suzuki, and Japan was the first to show that
thimerosal, which is acetylsalicylic acid, you might say. He showed and confirmed by Margos and others that the sulfur bond to the benzene ring is split very, very quickly, very rapidly.
Would you agree, sir, that in the human body, ethyl mercury binds to red blood cells, proteins, and other molecules, so that the entire dose of thimerosal in a thimerosal-containing vaccine does not come into contact with the dendritic cells?
I don't know, but I would be surprised if they did not come in contact, because what you've got to understand...
I'm not asking you whether it comes into contact. I'm asking you whether a portion of that ethyl mercury binds to red blood cells, proteins, and other molecules so that the entire dose does not come into contact with the dendritic cells in the human body.
That's reasonable.
Do you know what percentage of ethyl mercury binds to red blood cells in human beings?
I would hazard a guess, but I better not.
Would it surprise you if it were 90%?
That would not surprise me.
But in the Goff and Agarwal studies, the entire amount of thimerosal is able to affect the dendritic cells. There's nothing else in there for the thimerosal to bind to. Is that correct? The entire exposure of the thimerosal is to the dendritic cell. Is that correct?
I don't understand it. Again, you have to get closer to your microphone. I'm sorry.
when you put the thimerosal in the in vitro study on the dendritic cell, there is no binding to red blood cells, proteins, or other molecules. Is that correct?
I don't know that that is correct. I would expect that there are many agents in a cell, in a dendritic cell, to which ethyl mercury would bind.
Does the Goth or Agarwal study tell you that? Or is this you're guessing?
I'm not guessing. I'm using 50 years of experience and research as to the properties of a thiol compound and what that thiol compound would react with. And it would react with many, many constituents in a cell.
But there's one dendritic cell, and that gets the entire exposure of the thimerosal in the in vitro studies performed by Goth and Agarwal. Is that correct?
Again, I can repeat the question.
I apologize. Then, would you agree that the thimerosal in the Goth and Agarwal studies is exposed only to the dendritic cells in the in vitro studies?
Yes.
Thank you. And it is your opinion that based on those two studies, that it is more likely than not that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause immune suppression in humans?
I think that the amount of mercury in the amount of thimerosal in those experiments could cause immune suppression.
Is it more likely than not? More likely than not.
I think it's more likely that it will cause immune suppression.
And that's based on those two studies, is that correct?
I have more faith in the Agarwal paper because they dealt with human cells. Other paper dealt with non-cells.
Assuming that thimerosal can cause immune suppression, do these studies demonstrate how long that immune suppression will last?
No, but papers by a Swedish group, the author's name begins with H, and I can never pronounce it, did point out that the immune suppression lasts. The statement he made was a lengthy period.
A lengthy period?
That was what the paper said.
Do you recall? You didn't file that paper with your report, did you, sir?
I don't remember whether it's in my report or not. It would be on the last page of the text, if I could see that.
You should have your report with you, sir.
No, it's not in here. But it's a very well-known paper.
Well, if I ask Ms. Chin Kaplan to supply that paper, will you supply that to her?
Mm-hmm.
If I ask your petitioner's counsel to supply that paper, could you provide that to her, please?
Absolutely. In fact, when our immunologist comes before the court, I would suspect she'll have that paper. There are two or three papers by the same author.
And you said it's a lengthy period? You stated that the immune suppression lasts for a lengthy period?
The term I remember is lengthy.
You can't quantify her.
I don't think... I looked in the paper for some more of a statement, and in that one particular paper that I was reading, I could not get a more exact description of the science.
Is it your opinion that the ethyl mercury causes a persistent immunosuppression even after it is no longer in the blood?
It's complicated because ethyl mercury will break down to mercuric mercury, and mercuric mercury will also cause immunosuppression.
Where does ethyl mercury break down into mercuric mercury? That does that occur in the brain, sir? Is that correct? Does ethyl mercury break down into mercuric mercury in the brain? Is that correct?
Everywhere, in most cells. There's nothing novel about the brain. What's novel about the brain is it can't, the mercuric mercury cannot come out of the brain. We have mercuric mercury from ethyl mercury, especially in the kidney.
But this, did you say it was a Swedish study that you just cited to?
Scandinavian study.
Scandinavian study. When you say lengthy period, that also means that at some point the body returns to its normal immune state, that it does not last for...
I'm not an immunologist, so I agree. I wasn't reading the paper looking for that. I was reading the paper to see what I could learn about the properties of the various species of mercury as far as immunosuppression.
But lengthy period would refer to a start and an end, whatever that is. Is that correct?
Yeah.
You don't. Is it your belief that Michelle Cedillo received thimerosal-containing vaccines that suppressed her immune system prior to the receipt of her MMR?
It's my professional
belief that the thimerosal problem triggered something that caused immune suppression in Michelle. Thimerosal may have done it per se, but I doubt that. Thimerosal triggered some other reaction in the body that caused immune suppression.
What is your evidence for that?
The evidence would be based on, I believe, some experiments that Ellen Silverio has done, in which she showed the immunological properties of mercury. Which species or all the species. But I think she reported in a paper given to Finland I think it was 202 or 203. The paper is in the press, it's published in Toxicology and Applied Pharmacology. I believe she refers to some experiments that were done in her lab on immune suppression caused by mental species, mercury species. But I don't remember the
You don't remember the details, but you're relying on that article to form your opinion that there was a trigger.
Because I read the paper very carefully at the time, came to a conclusion, and then went on to other things.
Does the amount of time between the last thimerosal-containing vaccine that Michelle received and the receipt of her MMR vaccination make a difference as to whether she was immune suppressed?
I'm not an immunologist. I would not want to try to speculate on what I believe in that respect.
Is there any evidence? You said you looked at some of the medical records. Is that correct? And I know you're not an immunologist, but is there any evidence in the medical records that you reviewed that Michelle Cedillo was immune suppressed between the time of her thimerosal-containing vaccines and the time she received her MMR vaccination?
I'm a toxicologist. I'm not an immunologist. I just think about toxicological aspects of the article. In immunology, I usually skip over it because I'm not an immunologist.
Are there any studies that show that ethyl mercury in the brain can cause immune suppression?
I
You cite in your opinion to the Ashwood article, and that is attachment C of your report. Would you like us to hand you that report so I can ask you some questions?
The statement that was made just to form a liaison with the other articles, with the other reports that were being done by the authors, trying to make a connection between Iberis Law, Washington, and the authors. That's the only reason that was put in there. That is the, I think it's the last step.
I'm sorry?
I think it's the last sentence.
Of your report, are you referring to the Ashwood article? I'm not sure the last sentence of what you're referring to.
You're right, Doctor. It's in the last sentence of your report.
Of your report. I'm sorry. Does the Ashwood article indicate that thimerosal plays a role in immune dysfunction in some autistic children? You state on page 9 of your report, that some children can receive 185.5 micrograms of ethylmercury from a thimerosal-containing vaccine during the first 14 weeks of life. Is that correct?
Where on the page, Ms. Renzi? I think I see it. It's in the under thimerosal and childhood vaccines. It's the fifth line down.
I was asking about 185.5 micrograms of ethylmercury received through thimerosal-containing vaccines.
So some children can receive 185.5 micrograms of ethylmercury from thimerosal-containing vaccines?
Yes. Did Michelle Cedillo receive how much mercury? You've calculated how much ethylmercury Michelle Cedillo received. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you have that handy?
Doctor, do speak up a little bit. When you go down to look at that, we lose you a little bit.
The data that I have with me is perhaps more relevant. It's on micrograms of mercury per kilogram body weight in the case of a stillborn child. And the highest cumulative dose was about 10.7, I think it is, micrograms of mercury per kilogram body weight. It's in the report that was handed to you this morning.
Did you calculate that? Did you calculate that number?
Yes.
And what was it? What was it based upon? I'm sorry. What was it based upon?
Based on the amount of mercury, cumulative amount of mercury that Michelle was exposed to at a certain date, and then that was converted to micrograms of mercury.
Could you give me the specific numbers, please?
Micrograms of mercury from her vaccines. During the first 4 months of her life, she received 75 micrograms per mercury.
That's, and my question to you is, she received a total of 135 micrograms over her first 18 months of life. Is that what you said?
She received 137.5 micrograms of mercury by Marisol during the first 18 months of her life.
And is that how much she accumulated in her blood at any one time?
This is what she was exposed to. This is the amount of mercury. This is the amount of mercury that she was, the total amount of mercury that was injected into her over a unit period of time.
But if you measured her blood levels at any one time?
It had nothing to do with blood levels at this stage. It's data is what she was injected with. The amount of mercury she was injected with for exposure.
Okay, so at any given, I know I'm repeating myself, if you could answer yes or no. At any given time, did Michelle Cedillo have 135 micrograms of ethyl mercury in her body?
At the day of her last vaccination, which I gathered was when she was 15 months of age, if you added up all the mercury that she had received in her vaccinations up until the age of 18 months, it came to 137.5 micrograms.
So that's
what she literally was injected with, was exposed to over this period of time.
You believe that autism is caused by an efflux disorder. Is that correct?
I believe that, first of all, autism is not a single disorder. We have autistic spectrum disorders. At one end of this spectrum, as it's called, is Asperger's disease. The other end is very severe autism. Now, when a chemist looks at a spectrum, the chemist looks for individual bands. This has not been done with the autism spectrum disorders. So it probably, the autism spectrum disorders are probably made up of a different group of diseases with similar signs and symptoms. Okay. Now, one of them probably is due to one of these specific diseases that fall into the autism spectrum disorders definition is probably due to children having a mercury efflux disorder.
So I may not be understanding you, so correct me if I'm wrong. Can you identify those children based on their symptoms or based on where they are in the spectrum, whether it was caused by an efflux disorder?
We can, on the basis of the Adams work, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
On the basis of the Adams paper, we just came up to 07, we can identify those children who have more mercury in their teeth than other children. Right? What we want to do eventually, and it's a territorial nightmare, is to get the brain tissue of deceased autistic children and to get other tissues from deceased autistic children and analyze them and compare them down to a proper control to see if the mercury level in them is excessive.
But you don't have those brain tissues, is that correct? No one has done the experiments on those brain tissues. So you have the tooth study. Is that the basis for your conclusion that mercury, autism is caused by a mercury efflux disorder?
No. You could have taken into consideration the hair experiment by Holmes, which was confirmed by the MIT group, number one. You have to take into consideration the Bradstreet experiment, which showed that the DMSA indicated a greater body burden of mercury in autistic children. And you have to take into consideration the Adams experiments on the teeth.
You didn't mention two other studies that I will mention today. One is the IP study from 2004, and the other is the Kern study from 2007. Are you familiar with those studies?
I'm familiar with one of the IP studies.
IP.
And what was that study about?
These studies failed to replicate the hair studies in the Holm study.
I'm not surprised, because hair studies are probably the most difficult studies to replicate. There's no question about the fact that if hair studies are not done in an experienced arbitrator who has experience doing them as to the values of means.
So it's your opinion that the Holm study was done right, but that the IF study was not. Is that correct?
The Holm study was done at the doctor's data, which probably analyzes more mercury samples than any other place in the world. And they have been certified, they've been approved by the FDA for doing hair.
And what do you know about the Kern paper?
There are two, so you're going to tell me which Kern paper you're talking about.
The 2007.
Pardon?
2007?
Can you just have the title, please?
I'll have to get it. It's the hair study. It's the Kern hair study. Is there more than one? And I'll add.
Well, the Kern also was the Adam study. And I thought Kern was an author on the Adam study. But the Kerns are all Kerns, I remember, is a psychiatrist from Dallas or someplace in Texas, I think. And I think what they did was look at the self-hybrid in autistic children versus not autistic children. And I don't think it was a very good study. And when I do a quick read on a study that I don't think is very good, I don't bother with it.
Are you familiar with the IP study? IP, IP. Are you familiar with it?
Yes, I saw it. Actually, they gave me a copy of the paper.
And what is that study about?
I think they more or less could not repeat some results. There are other papers I should tell you about in case you don't know about them.
Please do.
That is, there's a paper that came out of Missouri which claimed that autistic children when given DMSA, did not excrete an increase in mercury. But if you quote that paper, the answer to it is almost none of their subjects, normal or autistic children, excreted very much of any mercury. So my guess is that whoever did their mercury analysis don't know what they're doing. This is from a clinical toxicology or emergency medicine group, I think at the University of Missouri. And when you look at that paper, you just have to say, wow, how did things get with this? So not all scientific papers, even peer-reviewed journals, are good.
Please, go ahead,
Doctor. I'm almost done, but we can take a break if you would like to.
Doctor, let me take this time to apologize to you, too. We are trying to get you to speak up, and it turns out your microphone wasn't in proper working order, so I apologize. Go ahead, Ms. Renzi.
Doctor, you stated earlier today that not everyone who gets vaccinated gets autism. Is that correct?
Of course.
And you said that it's the timing that is critical as to why some children develop autism and some children do not.
That's what I do think.
So they have to receive an immunization at a very during a very specific window in order to develop autism. Was that your testimony
that
today?
A possibility that to me seems reasonable.
Is it more likely than not, or is this? Is it more likely than not that this theory Has this theory been proven by anyone else? I'll start with that.
In science, we get some experimental results, we get some data, and we try to understand the data. And then when we try to understand the data, we set up a hypothesis. The hypothesis eventually will be proven correct or incorrect. The hypothesis that I've offered is that perhaps there is a very narrow window for children who are vaccinated to have an effect on the developmental system and therefore causing autism. And that some children may not get vaccinated in that window and other children may. So there's a variability here. And this is a hypothesis.
So in your hypothesis, let's assume that Michelle Cedillo got vaccinated at 2 months and 1 day. And she developed autism following her MMR vaccine. So she received thimerosal-containing vaccines at 2 months and 1 day, and then went on to get a MMR vaccine at 15 months and developed autism.
But she also got a vaccination, I think it was 7 months before. I think the MMR is what the 12 or what the MMR is given.
She received her first MMR at 15 months.
At 15 months, okay. I think she got her last mercury-containing vaccination. The MMR does not have mercury in it. Probably around 7 months. Am I correct? No, I haven't figured it out.
I think you are correct. About nine months earlier, that is correct.
So it is possible that that window at that time was very narrow, enough to cause some kind of
Which window are you talking about? Is this the window when she received her thimerosal-containing vaccine, or the window that is between the time of her receipt of her thimerosal-containing vaccine and the exact day she received her MMR vaccine?
I hypothesize that it is the window when she received that last 7 month dose of vaccine, mercury thimerosal-containing vaccine.
The Pekikero paper, excuse me, found a half-life of mercury in the blood of 7 days. Is that correct?
What kind of mercury?
Ethyl mercury in the blood.
You're talking about when thimerosal was injected?
Yes.
And are you talking about the humans or are you talking about the monkeys?
I am talking about the Pekikero paper with the humans.
Okay. All right.
Now, which paper are you talking about? The Pichichiro paper?
Yes.
Okay.
What's your question?
You said that there was a flaw with that study, that you can't compare that to the autistic children who receive vaccines as to the half-life of ethyl mercury in their blood. Is that correct?
What I did say, I believe, was that autistic children, if they have a mercury ethyl disorder, they have different toxic. And that data in normal children may not be applicable at all to a child who cannot get rid of mercury of his or her sex.
Is there any evidence, are there any papers that confirm your hypotheses on that?
I think, if you're talking about
whether autistic children have a longer half-life of ethyl mercury in the blood. Are there any articles, peer-reviewed articles, that state that autistic children...
I don't know if that's enough. I don't think any mother would want more ethyl mercury injected into her autistic child knowing what's happening. So I doubt that experiment would be done in humans.
You also stated in your testimony today that immune suppression is significant in the development of autism. Is that correct?
I think I may have said that one of, in that figure that I showed, that one of the possible pathways for ethylmercury triggering something would first trigger immune dysregulation, and this would lead to immunosuppression. Again, that was a model that I had on the screen, and again, it's hypothesis.
Have any papers or are peer-reviewed articles confirmed your hypothesis?
The hypothesis was made less than 3 or 4 weeks ago, but the answer is no.
You also stated in your testimony today that there are genes involved in the handling of mercury in the body.
Yes.
Are these genes polymorphic?
Yes. In part, I said that at the present time, we only have proof for one such gene that is affected by mercury. There probably are others, but there's no paper published about this.
Has anyone tested Michelle Sadio for this gene?
There are certain rules and regulations that must be followed before an academic institution, an academic person, can do something with a child, with a human, especially a child. I would not be surprised if those experiments have been done at the University of Washington. But at the present time, I don't know whether they have or not.
If
the study was published in 2005, 2 years ago, so maybe a year and a half. Those studies, in order to get through the Human Subjects Committee, will take a while. So I would be amazed if those studies are not ongoing at the present time.
So could any of the 5,000 children that now have claims before this court get that genetic test, be identified with that gene, and then we could determine that that particular person's autism was caused by the handling of the mercury due to that gene defect?
First of all, one must realize there are many genes involved in mercury toxicity. Right? There are different genes that convert elemental mercury to purified mercury. There are different genes that convert ethyl mercury to purified mercury. Once you get the results, let's say autistic child X has a faulty gene that causes a different porphyrin urine profile. It's another case to be able to prove that gene, the defect in that gene causes autism. Just because a child has it and a normal child doesn't mean that that is the cause. And what has to be done, believe it or not, talk about in vitro experiments, what has been done with other diseases and similar genes, is you take that gene and put it to the yeast. And the yeast can reproduce many of the effects that you find in a human being by a gene. You can produce many of the transport efflux disorders found in humans in the yeast. So, which still amazes me, but it's true.
Now, you stated earlier that even if there is a genetic susceptibility in autistic children to retain mercury, does every child who has autism have that efflux disorder?
As I said earlier, we have autism spectrum disorder, a group of diseases. I don't think any physician that I know of would say that the autism spectrum disorder diseases are just one disease or one disorder. There's Asperger's on one. Do you know what Asperger's is?
Yes, I do.
The infants are very unusually gifted children. And then, so these are very, very gifted children, one way. And then we have the very, very severe autism children at the other end. In between, we have all sorts of variations. So one cannot say that all these autistic kids have the same disorder, the same genetic disorder at this stage.
Is there any way you can determine whether a child has this genetic susceptibility to autism? Since it's
there are papers about this, actually, one from Rutgers, and we should agree that there's an excellent review article on the genetics of autism from the Mass General Hospital. Mass General, I know you're down here in Washington, but Mass General Harvard Hospitals are considered to be the Meccas of American medicine, as hospital is. There's a very good review article that came up two or three years ago. It's so good that I stopped and sent an email to someone I didn't even know, saying what a wonderful article it was. She was shocked to receive such a comment. I was shocked that week.
Now, did you cite it in your report? Did you cite that article in your report?
No, because I didn't see any need to cite that article at the time. It's just a review.
But it talks about genetic susceptibility. It's an excellent article about genetic susceptibility in autism.
That was an article pointing out the theory of the month as far as which gene causes autism. We really don't have any specific data. But there are two, there is one expert, one paper coming out of Rutgers that is highly flawed. I don't remember the name of the author, but people did.
I have no further questions. Thank you, Doctor.
All right.
I'm sorry that I interrupted you.
And I'm sorry if I interrupted you, sir.
Let's take a restroom break at this time, and we'll be back in 15 minutes.